Hi, this is Steve Nerlich.
Why cheap astronomy?
Yeah, why?
And this is Dear Cheap Astronomy, episode 105, Life and Death. As we gain an increasing understanding of the birth and ultimate heat death of the universe, it's hard not to be struck by the essential pointlessness of all things. On the bright side, though, a lot of stuff goes on between the beginning and the end. People, for example, are certainly busy doing this and that, although you sometimes have to wonder whether there's a lot of point in what they do either. For example,
Dear Cheap Astronomy, just how useful are humans in space? The first episode of Star Trek: The Next Generation has Commander Riker proving his collar studs by redocking the drive section of the Enterprise with the saucer section manually, where manually largely involved him looking steely while delivering a few verbal commands to the bridge crew, who exchanged astonished glances in between tapping their touchscreens to implement those commands, which was apparently the easy part of the operation. It remains unclear how a redocking is achieved non-manually. Presumably, everyone just goes off for a coffee while it happens. But anyhow, that story exemplifies the theme of this episode. If you don't have to do things manually, why do you need people to undertake space exploration? Just by landing robots on Mars, we've been able to take lots of photos, smell the air, feel the ground, and listen to the wind blow. We've got bogged in difficult terrain, but also climbed hills to take in the view, and we've even operated a drone there. Sending people to Mars is a lot more fraught, since the mission has to be loaded down with everything you need for life support, and with current propulsion technologies, those people will be sitting in a tin can for literally years to get to Mars and back again. And with current technologies, all we can actually do is get people there. The only current viable plan we have to get them home again is for them to manufacture their own rocket fuel from in situ resources. But before we even get to the landing, just keeping humans alive in space requires huge technological overheads, even though those humans will be pretty much useless during a journey to Mars. After all, we've been remotely piloting spacecraft to Mars for decades now. So the astronauts' main purpose in being on the spaceship is just so they can get off at the destination. Of course, given the crew will be traveling with life support, they will have their hands full with lots of maintenance tasks to attend to, and they'll have to exercise for several hours a day to stay in shape. So they will be busy, just not with piloting. They might play a more active role in the landing, but who knows really, since we don't actually know how we're going to land yet. We might fly a lander along with the astronauts, or send the lander on ahead so it's waiting there in orbit when they arrive. There's no doubt that humans and their life support represent too much mass for either a bouncy ball or a sky crane landing that we've used for robots. So the human lander will have to come all the way down on retro rockets, which would presumably lie behind a heat shield as the lander enters the atmosphere before the heat shield is jettisoned well above the ground. This is the complexity of landing on Mars. It's got enough atmosphere that you need a heat shield, but not enough atmosphere so that parachutes are enough to slow you to a soft landing. They will slow you a bit, but you'll need another strategy to avoid a destructive hard landing on the surface. Nonetheless, despite having no real landing plan, let alone landing hardware, the official line continues to be that we'll be landing on Mars sometime in the 2030s, although regular cheap astronomy listeners will be aware that we think there's a snowball's chance in a supernova of that happening. We reckon give it a few more years, and everyone will be saying the landing will be sometime in the 2040s. But anyway, Let's assume we do get humans on Mars one day. Will it all have been worth it? There'll be no radio delay, so humans can turn over interesting rocks as soon as they spot them, and they can probably wield a rock hammer with more dexterity than a rover could manage. And since they will be going home again, they can take lots of Mars rock samples with them. Of course, that same option would exist if we ever decided to fly our robots home again. It's just that we don't. So, in a nutshell, there are definitely some gains in sending humans, but those gains come at a huge cost and a real risk that you can't return those people safely to the Earth. Which is bad for those people, as well as for the government or private enterprise that was responsible for sending them. So, sending humans to Mars might become worthwhile when it can be done faster, safer, and cheaper. But in the meantime, let's keep sending in the robots.
This is the middle bit.
We should never forget that we built the robots that are out there exploring the universe. Although it remains to be seen if they'll end up remembering us. And of course, we need to remember that we live in a universe that could easily kill us. For example,
Dear Cheap Astronomy, what is the death zone radius of a black hole merger? The background to this question is the gravitational wave data we've been collecting from LIGO, the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory. The data received can be reverse engineered to quantify the astronomical event that caused the gravitational waves detected. So, for example, the first gravitational wave detection on the 15th of September 2014, called GW150914, is thought to have arisen from the merger of two black holes of 36 and 29 solar masses respectively at a distance of 1.3 billion light-years away, where that merger formed a 62 solar mass black hole. If you're thinking 36 and 29 actually equals 65, you're right. The remaining three solar masses were converted into the energy of the resulting gravitational waves. That is a fair whack of energy, but remember that energy from a point source spreads outwards in a sphere, so the energy declines by the inverse square of the distance it covers. So our question becomes, how much closer do you have to be to the merger that energy might kill you? Here we need to consider what harm wave energy can do. The shock wave from a nearby explosion can kill you, but that's a wave of energy transmitted through the atmosphere. So really, you are killed by the pressure of air molecules being rapidly shifted in your direction. If the same thing happened in a vacuum, and you weren't hit by any flying shrapnel, the only effect on you would be a bright flash of heat and light. With a big enough explosion, that heat and radiation might still kill you, but that would be death by electromagnetic radiation, not pressure. With gravitational waves, the energy involved is even less tangible. You're really just dealing with a reverberation in space-time, remembering that general relativity tells us that gravity is not a force, it's just a change in space-time geometry. So the only way for a gravitational wave to transfer its energy to a material object is through distorting the space-time that object occupies. This could result in some energy transfer, where there's stretching that produces heat, but for the most part, gravitational waves pass through matter without imparting much of their energy at all. Although, of course, the stretching could be a problem. After all, the classic death by black hole scenario is where you get spaghettified. So, rather than worry about the energy carried by a gravitational wave, we should maybe consider the amplitude of that wave, where a small wave passing through an object will stretch it a bit, and a big wave passing through an object will stretch it a lot. If it's gravitational wave amplitude that defines what the death zone radius is, then we should be aware that amplitude just declines inversely, not inverse squarely. So if you double the distance, you halve the amplitude, not quarter it. This might sound a bit serious, but consider that at a distance of 1.3 billion light-years, the amplitude of the waves arising from the GW150914 event was sufficient to stretch the 1.6 kilometre arm of LIGO by a tenth of a width of a proton. Had the event been a billion times closer, that would be just 1.3 light-years away, and then the arm would have stretched by a whole 4 nanometres. Which means the entire diameter of the Earth might have stretched by a hundredth of a millimetre. In other words, it's still f*** all. From 10,000 kilometres away, the waves from that black hole merger could create a stretch in the order of 1 in 1,000. So that might stretch LIGO's arm by 1.6 centimetres. So that kind of stretch might cause significant earthquakes and hence potential deaths on Earth. But if you were floating in a spacesuit at that distance, you might get stretched by a whole 1 millimetre, which you'd certainly feel, but it probably wouldn't kill you. However, if you were 10,000 kilometres from a black hole merger, you would die for other reasons. If either black hole had an accretion disk of superheated material, the radiation would kill you. And even without an accretion disk, from 10,000 kilometres away, it would be hard to stop yourself from falling in until gravitational tidal forces killed you by spaghettification or something just as geometrically nasty, remembering you would be approaching two rapidly inspiraling black holes. So it's the black holes themselves that will kill you rather than their gravitational waves. And if you are far enough away that those other proximity effects won't kill you, then the gravitational waves won't kill you either.
This is the end bit.
So, there you go. It's always a good idea to keep a respectful distance between yourself and a black hole. But as long as you do that, you should be okay. And as we've discussed, you'd probably be no use anyway, even if you were near a black hole. It's best just to stay home and let the robots sort it out. But that's it for another episode of Dear Cheap Astronomy. If you've got a space science question, or you're just feeling a bit stretched, why not write to cheapastro@gmail.com and we'll halve the amplitude for you. Thanks for listening. Steve Nerlich, Cheap Astronomy.